You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 24th, 2007. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. And joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello.
Jay Novella.
Hey, what's up?
And Evan Bernstein.
Howdy do.
Good evening, everyone.
Do. Jesus Christ.
I used to live in Dallas.
What?
So I could say howdy.
Yeah. We are back from Las Vegas and the amazing Meeting 5.
Ooh. It was amazing.
Fantastic.
It was absolutely fabulous.
I was really happy you guys made it this year.
Oh, yeah.
We had to go. This was the best TAM ever. I've been to the past three, and this one trumped them all by a mile. Like the speakers, the parties, everything. It was so much fun.
The interviews, the booze.
Yeah. The booze.
Yeah, it was awesome. The speakers were all wonderful, you know, and we had the opportunity to interview many of the guests. I'll just run down the list of the people that we interviewed during TAM 5. James Randi, of course, Todd Robbins, Hal Bidlack, who was the master of ceremonies, John Rennie, the editor-in-chief of Scientific American, Eugenie Scott, Michael Shermer, Julia Sweeney, Jim Underdown, who runs the CFI West in Hollywood, Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, Richard Wiseman, Scott Dickers, who's the editor of The Onion, Peter Sagal, who's the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR, Adam Savage and Tori from the Mythbusters, Christopher Hitchens, who is a political commentator, Teller, the other half of the silent, usually silent half of Penn and Teller, and Matt Stone, one of the creators of South Park. So it was really great to interview all of those wonderful people. Everyone was so nice too. I mean, I was really not so much surprised as just very pleased that everyone was so willing to sit with us and spend a lot of time and chat with us.
We couldn't get some of them to shut up.
And I would like to add, you know, meeting the fans, people that came out that wanted to meet us, we were absolutely shocked every single time somebody walked up to us. My favorite part, hands down, my favorite part next to Matt Stone, of course, was meeting people that were interested in the show, that listened to the show, and we had an awesome time at the Rebecca. What was that? The Star Trek bar?
Quark's Bar.
Yeah. One of the geekiest places on the planet.
I had the biggest, nerdiest drinks on the planet.
The geekiest place on Earth.
What was that drink you and Jay shared? A warp core brew?
Yeah.
We had and then the other one was a Borg cube or something? A Borg sphere.
Borg sphere.
Hey, let's give a shout out to some of the fans that we have down here.
Such as? Would you like to?
Well, Elizabeth, Rich, and Fred, and Jonathan.
And Xander.
Those are some names that leap to mind.
The guy that gave Perry the disc, Noah Miller from, where was he from? Well, we saw him at the Star Trek bar. He gave Perry a present, and I said, well, what is it? It's a CD, and he goes, it's basically a bunch of monkey media.
Monkey media. That's fantastic.
Monkey media. Nice alliteration. Perry will love that.
Was that the same fellow who gave us the, what do you call it, the Marvel comic?
The Neil Adams comic book?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. You know, every year I say the same thing, but it's always true. The thing that really makes TAM, I mean, the speakers are wonderful, the hotel's always cool, Vegas is great, but the thing that really makes it is always the people, like the people just attending the conference. Mm-hmm. They are fantastic, the best in the world. I always have so much fun, and there's never enough time to do everything. Every time you turn around, there's a big group getting together and going somewhere and doing something. They were just an outrageously good time.
It's a good group of people, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say that I had a rocking party Saturday night, to which a lot of listeners attended, as did you guys, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. As did hotel security.
Eventually.
Yep. Yeah.
They enjoyed it.
It got broken up at 2:30 in the morning. It did.
Apparently, yeah.
And a cop. There was a cop with the security guy.
Oh, was there?
He had a few drinks, and then he broke it up.
I heard competing reports that said it was the cops that broke it up, and some people said it was hotel security. So I guess it was both.
They were together, yep. Absolutely.
Nice. Legendary.
So our listeners may be wondering what we're going to do with all those great interviews we recorded. I believe, Evan, we have over 6 hours of raw material.
Wow. We sure do.
Which is wonderful. What we are going to be doing is including excerpts from all of those interviews in the next few, this podcast, and then in the next few episodes, the highlights, if you will. But it's too much content to put directly into all of our podcast.
Your mind would be blown.
Right. But what we're going to do for those listeners who can't get enough is we're going to put uncut interviews with our commentary added that we will upload them in addition to our weekly podcast. Now, this is something else that we've been talking about, and this is, I think, the perfect opportunity to do it. What some podcasts do is they in addition to their free podcast, they put extra material on a pay-per-download basis on iTunes or whatever. And that's a great way to both generate money for the New England Skeptical Society to help run our organization, help run our podcast, while in addition providing extra bonus content for our loyal listeners. So
for $50 an interview, you get it all. You'll be all set.
Well, we're thinking about like $2 an interview for about an hour of material, and you know, we may put it into some kind of package deal for the whole thing. We're still working out the details, so we'll let you know when those things start going up. But in the meantime, you'll be able to listen to the highlights of these interviews this week and over the next few weeks. It's going to be awesome. And while we're talking about the interviews, we have to give a big official Skeptics Guide thank you to Jeff Wagg.
Jeff
is the executive director of the JREF, and we actually spoke with him last week, if you recall, about the changes that are being made to the Randy Psychic Challenge. Well, Jeff was basically running this TAM 5. He was running the meeting behind the scenes. He was doing
excellent job.
Oh my God, yeoman's work.
And he helped us out every step of the way. He helped hook us up with the speakers so that we can get interviewed. He gave us space to do it. He was an all around help. Would not have been nearly as successful if it weren't for him. So thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. It was great to meet you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Didn't actually get to have a drink with him because he was so busy, but he hooked us up every chance he could, and it really is going to – everyone
it's
out
okay.
there –
I have drinks with him at least once a month, so I'll have extra next time.
Definitely.
But, you know, we all benefit from him helping us because we have 6 hours of content now that we can – we're going to sprinkle into the show.
The other thing that was kind of a first at TAM 5 was this was the first time we recorded anything for the show where we were all sitting together in the same place physically.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I had actually never met Jay before.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was my first meeting of Jay face to face, and it was let me think
religious,
of a good adjective.
mind blowing.
Transcendent.
Adequate. That would be a good one.
Oh my God! I just totally feel like I was standing nude in front of an audience. Anyway, I do have a picture of that wonderful moment in both of our lives, which will be up on the website. I'm going to I'm finishing up the start of a gallery that we're putting together. Everyone's sending me their pictures. Any listeners out there that want to help, I will put a link on the homepage. That will basically just say, you know, send them to this email address. I haven't decided which address we're going to use yet, but you'll see it on the homepage. And please do just send me the pictures. I'll put them up as they come in.
Thanks, Jay.
There was some news coming out of TAM 5.2 as well, rather. Sylvia Brown is continuing her downward spiral.
Yeah.
Hopefully into oblivion. We can always be hopeful.
The media is finally starting to catch on that she's a fraud and a liar.
You may remember in the news recently, a teen was kidnapped, and he was tracked down to this guy's house, and in the house was found another teen who had been captive for 4 years. The guy was being held captive for 4 years. So this was the Sean Hornbeck case. It turns out that about 3 years ago, the parents of Sean Hornbeck consulted Sylvia Brown on the Montel Williams show, and we'll have a link to the video of this session. But Sylvia Brown basically told them that their son was dead, gave directions to where the police should look for his body, and said that the person who kidnapped him was Hispanic with dreadlocks. It turns out that he wasn't dead. That, you know, the location she gave was just wasted the police time and effort searching in the wrong direction, and the guy who kidnapped him was white with short hair. He didn't have dreadlocks. So she that was an utter failure on the part of Sylvia Brown. But like other recent cases, it's like she just keeps digging herself deeper in terms of the cruelty of this. I mean, you see the parents break down on the Montel Williams show when they're told that their son is dead. And you just get the sense that Sylvia just doesn't care. You know, she's just telling devastating news to these parents that she's essentially making up, and she knows it. And it's just, it's absolutely heartless.
Have you guys read Sylvia's message on her website in response to all of the criticism she's gotten from that?
Yeah, I think it was, I've seen her spokesperson's response. Is that what you're talking about?
According to her website, it's from her.
Okay.
And first of all, let's say that Randy and Robert Lancaster went after her. You can check out StopSylviaBrown.com. And they're basically kicking her butt on this and publicizing all over the place. They were on Anderson Cooper the other night. And in response, Sylvia posted this on her website. Do you want me to read the full thing?
Yes. Okay.
Please.
Throughout history, there have always been psychics and skeptics. I am the first to caution everyone when dealing with those who claim to have paranormal ability and then bilk people to remove curses or bring back lost loves through potions or incantations. I have never, nor ever, will charge anyone who seeks my help regarding a missing person or homicide. In these cases, I choose to work strictly with law enforcement agencies involved to aid and not impede their work, and only when asked. To be accused of otherwise by James Randi and others like him is a bold-faced lie. The very nature of his work is negative, i.e., one that tries to disprove the very nature of spirituality. Can God be proven by scientific methods? If the brilliant scientists throughout history had a James Randi negating every aspect of their work, I doubt we would have progressed very far in medicine or in any technology. As I have stated on Montel, on my radio show, in my books, and in each of my lectures, I cannot possibly be 100% correct in each and every one of my predictions. I have never claimed to be. Those who choose to believe in our philosophy will continue to do so because of their own convictions. Those who negate it after one human error never truly embraced our philosophy anyway, and that's okay. My constant mantra is to take with you what you want and leave the rest. God's blessing to everyone regardless of their chosen path.
Okay, how many logical fallacies did you count?
Oh, God. It's stomach churning. I mean,
she doesn't get them all right, huh? Well, how about getting one right?
Yeah, just one would be
super. How
about
one?
And she outright lies. She says she's never charged anyone who seeks her help regarding a missing person or homicide. The parents said that she wanted to charge them $600 per hour, her normal fee, to consult with them. Or $700? Yeah. Just to consult with them about their missing / dead.
So why is it okay for her to tell these people wrong information? She says that, you know, her power must, if it's coming from a spiritual realm, it's safe to assume it's coming from God, right? Where else would it be coming from? Some type of spiritual realm, right?
Well, it depends on what your mythology is. It depends on what your belief system is. But she's just hiding behind God. She's trying to set it up as, you know, if I'm on God's side, if you believe in me, that's the work of God, and Randy's against God.
Right.
So if you believe anything Randi has to say, he's against God.
Talk about a false dichotomy.
Then she tries to say that Randi is against science, that if Randi were there nitpicking at scientists, that would impede the progress of science. Well, guess what? There are skeptics and people like Randi constantly at work within the field of science. That's
exactly
how science progresses.
Right. Randi is doing science.
It progresses by being as skeptical as possible. Absolutely. So Sylvia proves she doesn't understand the first thing about science, or she doesn't care.
Or she understands and would rather,
She doesn't care. I mean, you never know if she believes anything that she's saying.
I hate her so much.
Oh, God, Rebecca.
This is the downward spiral for her. I mean, she, unfortunately, she may survive this. I mean, she may survive this as in her trade. All people need is plausible deniability. People who want to believe in her, all they need is for her to make some vacuous statement like that, and that's enough for them.
Well, you know, and we've seen Randi over and over again destroy people like Peter Popoff, and then they go away, and their followers find someone else just like them to believe in, and then maybe they come back a few years later with a new spiel and attract a whole new following. So
Randi says they're unsinkable rubber duckies. They always bounce back.
But this is a huge blow to her. This is probably one of the biggest things she's ever done.
Right. It's unusual to have such a high-profile blow against a psychic. It is unusual, and unfortunately, my psychic prediction is that she will survive this. But what does that say about psychics in general, that they could, you know, potentially survive such a nasty blow? I mean, everybody's dissing her left and right.
It doesn't say as much about them as the people who believe in them.
Absolutely.
I know what you're saying.
So what would it take? What would it take to really?
Nothing. I mean, I don't think there's anything that could do it.
I'll tell you, here's what this is good for. First of all, there are a lot of fence sitters that have previously thought, oh, well, maybe there's something to that, that are now seeing that she is a fraud. You're not going to convince the true believers, but there are people out there who are on the fence who you will win over. And second of all, we can continue to combat it by, you know, teaching kids from a young age, showing them that this is all crap.
That's what needs to be done.
This is all about building a world where people like Sylvia Brown cannot exist. And this is just it's a piece of the puzzle. And it might be a small piece, but, you know, every piece is worth it. And we have Randy and Robert and a ton of other really great skeptics doing awesome work to thank for
you
this.
You notice that she didn't apologize to the parents or anyone?
That's a good point, Jay. No apology in there. You're absolutely right. I mean, somebody with any kind of class would have apologized for getting it wrong. She's just making apologies for herself. So, and what she's basically saying is, you know, I got it wrong. So, yeah, you can't be 100%. You know, you can get it wrong. But
she's sitting there speaking
with utter confidence. She's not saying, you know, I'm not certain about this. This is the probability of me being right. You know, sometimes, like, you know, doctors aren't right all the time either. But I tell patients, I try to give them a good sense of how certain or uncertain I am about things.
Right.
And that's sort of the standard. But there was no equivocation on her part. I see this. I know this. This is the way it is. Totally unequivocal. The second thing is there is a completely lame defense. It's like saying, you know, I can predict the sex of an unborn child, and if you give me, you know, $500, I'll tell you what kind of child the sex of your child is going to be, and in fact I'll also give you a money back guarantee if I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, you know that there is a company doing that. I blogged about them last month, I think. It's a really good scam. We can talk about it another time.
It's a great scam.
It is a good scam.
Right. It's like they call like a rainmaker scam. They promise you something that may happen anyway. If it happens, they take credit for it. If they don't, you know, just keep waiting or whatever. Something went wrong. Can't be right 100% of the time. But her hit rate is about as what you would expect from a lame cold reader, basically.
And her jab at Randy was that he is, you know, he basically is he's against science. He's against moving forward. He's against rational thought. What was that bit again? Rebecca, what did he say? What did she say bad again?
I had to close it. I can't even look at it anymore. <I'm sorry>. She said that if scientists had a Randy around to criticize them, we wouldn't have made great advances in technology and medicine, which is just utter BS.
We've gotten that too, you know, and usually that's followed up by a comparison of oneself to Galileo. Whenever anyone compares themselves to Galileo, you know they're a crank, right?
Galileo or Jesus. That's Jesus. The way to identify a crank.
What did I say? Oh. Or Einstein's. Remember that email, like around the turn of the millennium, there was this guy spamming emails about how he outperforms Einstein and he figured out time and space and all this.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
And then on, you know, when the world didn't end on, you know, January 1st, 2000, I emailed him just to see if he would respond. I said, well, have you revised your predictions for the end of the world? And never heard from him since.
Maybe he died.
Maybe he was like a Heaven's Gate kind of person who decided, well, if it didn't happen to everyone, it might as well happen to me, and off I go.
Uri Geller also took a hit. This is something else that was announced at TAM5. Randy talked about the fact that Uri Geller, you know, he has that television show in Israel where he is looking for his quote-unquote successor or heir, and these are basically young magicians who are, you know, who are pretending to, you know, do the same tricks that Uri Geller does, and they're essentially coached not to say whether or not what they're doing is, you know, prestidigitation or simple tricks, or whether or not they're mystical and magical. But and we discussed this with Randy himself, and you'll hear more about this during later in this episode during the interview with Randy. So, but it was nice to see yet another sort of iconic con artist taking a hit recently. So now the latest thing to come out of the Church of Scientology is that Tom Cruise, you know, I'm sure most people know who Tom Cruise is, Jay's favorite person. According to the leaders, quote-unquote leaders of Scientology, has been chosen to spread the word of his faith throughout the world, and he is being likened to none other than Jesus Christ. So he is to Scientology what Jesus was
imagine
to Christianity.
Imagine that. Huh. You know what?
Jay, imagine what do you think
I'll tell
of
you
that?
Right now, Jesus probably had 2 feet on Tom Cruise. Because everybody knows the guy's a midget to begin with.
True,
but could you imagine, you know, all kidding aside, Tom Cruise, leader of the Church of Scientology, pretty much, right? Like the figure.
I think it's match made in heaven, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How insanely pathetic can this guy get beyond that right there? That's it. He's hit, that is an all-time low. You can't get any lower than being heralded as the Jesus of Scientology in my book.
The Messiah of some pathetic cult.
If he's the Jesus, though, can does that mean we could beat the snot out of him and nail him to a cross?
You're saying he has to be martyred
at some point?
That's
not a threat or anything, but I'm just, well, yeah, I mean, that's the usual, if you look at the Jesus myth, that's what happened first,
yeah,
right, before the whole rise.
Well, all messiahs get martyred at some point.
They also mentioned in that article that future generations will look back on this and, you know, and Tom Cruise will be really thought of as an iconic figure for the church and everything. Yeah, that's true. He will. He will be looked on as an iconic figure by, like, the three people who are left in the Church of Scientology at the time.
Yeah, it depends on how big the religion is at that point in time. It's kind of like Joseph Smith to the Mormons. He was just some nutcase, you know, whatever, who made up some story about finding those golden tablets. No different than L. Ron Hubbard, really. And now he's, you know, an iconic figure in a major religion. That's what time does, unfortunately.
Well, it's perfect, though. The religion was created by a crappy science fiction writer, and now the leader of the church, the figurehead, is a crappy actor.
Yeah, I guess it kind of, there's some symmetry there, I guess.
Yeah, it all makes sense to me.
Well, let's go on and read a few emails before we start the first of our interviews. First email comes from Elizabeth Rawls from Oakland, California, and Elizabeth writes, "Hi guys, I really enjoyed meeting all of you at TAMP 5. So this is the Elizabeth that we spoke of before. And she writes, "Steve, I thoroughly enjoyed your talk on Sunday, and I can't wait to hear those interviews you all recorded. You may remember me as the fangirl who sat with the guys on the shuttle to the airport, and that chance to chat with you was the perfect way to end the best weekend of my life.
Wow.
For Rebecca, I'm so glad I got to meet you, and my suspicions were confirmed. We do look eerily similar.
I kept
saying that I am the version of Rebecca that eats meat. When someone sends me the photo of us together, I will pass it on. I imagine Perry will find it amusing that a carnivorous Rebecca doppelganger lives in California. Thanks, thanks again, and I love you all."
Perry's going to start lobbying to get her on the podcast.
Yeah, be careful.
To replace me.
Steve, did you tell Perry about her? Did anyone tell
I actually, I have not had a chance to chat with Perry about it yet. But so I just wanted to, you know, say, give a shout-out to Elizabeth. It was fun meeting you and all the other listeners out in California.
I want to say that Elizabeth is a very good example of exactly the sort of people we're trying to target. She's young and excited, and she wasn't that into the skeptical thing, the skeptical community, until, you know, she really started listening to our podcast, and then coming out to TAM, she looked like she was having a blast.
Yeah.
I guess she was. She said it was the best weekend of her life. And, it, you know, meeting Elizabeth was one of the highlights of my weekend, because, you know, that's exactly what we want to see, is more people getting enthused about skepticism and critical thinking. It was such a fantastic weekend because of that.
Yeah, you basically have somebody who's young and smart, but, you know, perhaps undifferentiated in their worldview, and we show them that science and skepticism can be really fun and interesting, and is a really sort of empowering way to approach life. And yeah,
right.
So meeting people like that, for us, that's gold. I mean, that's what makes all
of
our
not,
time
and not that
worthwhile.
Not that it was, you know, just us that did it, but I think that there's
this
whole culture that
we're... Yes, it was. No, we have 100%. Maybe there was some other contributors out there.
Yeah, I didn't see anyone else. I didn't see any other skeptics sitting on the bus with her. You know, Teller wasn't there exactly changing her ways.
Well, I'd like everyone to know... I want everybody to know that you had fun meeting us. We had fun meeting all of you guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And Rebecca, she really doesn't look a lot like you. In fact, on Thursday night when you were in your poker tournament, I saw her from across the room, and for a couple of seconds I thought she was you. until I got like a really good look at it.
I think it's mostly the glasses.
Yeah, yeah, it is, you're right.
She's got the same glasses.
You're right.
But yeah, it is a little eerie.
Well, good for Elizabeth, right?
Hi, Elizabeth. Yeah, thanks for listening.
So let's just do one more email since we want to reserve a lot of time for the interviews this episode, and we have our usual science or fiction and puzzle at the end. This one comes from Carl Linden from the United States, and he writes, "Hello, I love the show. In show number 77, someone mentioned that the feeling of weightlessness disappears after a few seconds, implying that one gets accustomed to weightlessness very quickly. As a skydiver, I've noticed the same thing, but I have attributed this to the fact that it only takes a few seconds to achieve terminal velocity, at which point you're not in true free fall and thus not weightless. You're only weightless when you're accelerating at 7 feet per second per second. At terminal velocity, you're no longer accelerating, but rather speeding along at a uniform rate, unless you do a barrel roll or something like that. I would say that after a few seconds, your situation is closer to resting on a cushion of air. Does this sound correct?" He goes on to ask another question, which we're not going to get to right now, and then he finishes up. "Anyway, thanks again for a great podcast. You're doing a great service, Carl." Thanks, as always, Carl. We love getting these great emails. And Carl, a couple other people other than Carl wrote in essentially the same thing. I think we had about three emails making the same point, and you're all absolutely correct. We checked into this just to make sure that we had all of our facts lined up. Basically, some of the confusion may come from the use of the term free fall, because in a physics point of view, free fall is a situation in which there is the only force that's acting upon you is gravity. There's no opposing force or any other forces acting upon you. So you could be in orbit, or you could be, you know, falling through a vacuum. Any of those situations would be considered free fall. When you're falling in a skydiving situation, you know, terminologically, that's also called "quote unquote free fall." But the term free fall in skydiving just means that you don't have a parachute deployed at the moment, so you're just falling through the air. So those two terms are don't mean different things depending on the context, and that causes some confusion. But basically, there's air resistance, and that the force of the air pushes up against you. That's an opposing force, which means you're technically not in free fall, you know, the physics term. In fact, the moment you start falling, you're getting increasing air resistance, and therefore you're less and less in a true free-for-all state until you approach, you know, after, depending on your aerodynamics, after really just a few seconds, like maybe 8 seconds, you get to pretty close to terminal velocity. And then it is like you're resting on a cushion of air. In fact, you guys ever see the these wind tunnels they have, where they basically have a really strong fan shoot pointing upwards, and you could be essentially like hovering.
Looks like fun.
Yeah, you hover above it.
Yeah, I would love to do that.
They have them in Vegas, actually, and I was like thinking fun, of going, yeah, but I didn't have enough time.
That's basically the same thing. That's the same thing as in being at terminal velocity when you're falling out of a plane. So thanks for the correction. We always appreciate it. And now let's move on to the first of our TAM 5 interviews. This week we are going to include highlights from our interview with James Randi, and Todd Robbins was sitting in with us on that interview. We're also going to include Hal Bidlack, who was the master of ceremonies for TAM 5. And then we'll finish up with Eugenie Scott. So here they are. Well, we are joined by the man himself, James the Amazing Randi, and Randy's wonderful to be at TAM 5. So how's the meeting been going from your perspective?
Oh, very well. First of all, we over 800 registration, which is
it's a beautiful
all-time thing. Record.
Great. That's a beautiful nice? Thing.
Yeah, mostly to see Todd, of course.
Well, yeah.
But some of them, maybe a couple to see me. No, it's very edifying, you know, and very satisfying that people have come from all across the world, literally all across the world, in order to be here. And boy, some of the adventures they had to go through to get here, I wouldn't do that to see me.
Well, you see yourself every day.
Well, I think what's special about this TAM is there is a sense of growth about it, and also the fact that the word is out that you're going to be doing a guest spot in Thunder Down Under, the strip show down the way here.
Oh, you shouldn't have told them about that.
And please. Can I say that they must have seen the Skeptude calendar, and that's why they...
Very true, very true. Very, no, it's very satisfying, and I'm very, very happy that so many people, so many talented people, including Todd, who came in at the last minute, more or less.
Yes, yeah.
He found himself in Las Vegas. I found myself in Las Vegas. Here I am. kind of thing. So we're very grateful for all of these people who volunteer their talents and their knowledge.
And there's been some, coincidentally, some nice press convergence on this. The two things, one is the update on the James Randi Million Dollar Psychic Challenge, which you talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So give us the... We've talked about it before with Jeff Wagg, actually, but if you just, in your own words, tell us, what's the vital change that you're making?
Well, very briefly, we're not leaving it open to every Tom, Dick, and Harry, because we waste our time with these people. These are people who don't know how to make a claim. They don't know what they think they can do. They're honest but deluded, and we get the reputation of only attacking the easy targets. So we're going to do two things from now on. First of all, we're changing the qualifications. People have to have some sort of a media presence. That means a television program or some major article, newspaper article or whatever, has to be done about them, or they've got to be mentioned in a book. The second thing is they have to have some sort of academic support, too. That is, some dunderhead of a scientist someplace has said, oh, yes, this must be real because I'm a PhD and no one can fool me. And we abound in people like this, of course. So those two things are the changes in the qualifications. We also will be challenging people directly. We're going after Uri Geller and Sylvia Brown. You may have heard of her. And, of course, James von Prague and John Edward. We're going after them as our first four targets, and we're going to nominate them on April the 1st as the people that we demand answers from. And it's going to last for 6 months. If they haven't answered this in 6 months, then we write them off and we simply say these are not people of good faith. They aren't willing to come forward and be tested. We already knew that, but this is going to be official this time. And we'll just drag up another roster of people that we can shoot at. Yeah. Have you heard, by the way, about what's happened to Geller lately? Because he's coming down the pike, too. Yeah. He's had some real comeuppances.
Well, yeah, I know there was a whole backlash in Israel about some
of these. The whole press, all of the media are against him. And they're calling him a liar, a cheat, a charlatan, a fake. And, and a member of the Israeli parliament has asked them to investigate him for being a disgrace to the country of Israel, to the land of Israel. By lying on television. Ooh, how did they come upon that?
there was a YouTube clip floating around.
Yeah, now the interesting thing about that YouTube clip is, and if you haven't seen
I haven't seen it.
Well, I'll act it out for you. You'll see what I'm meaning here. This doesn't work too well in audio.
No.
But he waves his hands.
Excuse me, if Edgar Bergen could do ventriloquism, you could do spoon bending on the radio, okay?
Mr. Bergen. that's true. He waves his hands around over a compass, okay, a big marine compass. But he does it too much. Methinks he doth protest too much. He waves his hands over as if to say, be sure that nothing is moving when my hands are moving over. It is perfectly still, right? Then there's a pause, and you see him do this sort of thing. With his right hand, he appears to press something onto his left thumb. Then he brings his hands apart, and he's concealing the left thumb. But when he puts his left hand out and waves it over the compass, it goes crazy.
That's interesting.
Wonder what that could be.
I must have sprained his thumb.
Something like that.
It was just massaging.
A disability of some kind. Yes. Now this was.
Well, you know, he's dealing with the science, and science is never reliable.
Science can be wrong.
Now he did this, and then it showed up on YouTube as well as the Israeli television channel. They have to run things for 2 weeks after they go on the air. So it was on both of them, but it suddenly disappeared from YouTube. And YouTube, when asked, said that Geller and the producers had asked that it be withdrawn. But then the producers withdrew it for a couple of hours and had to put it right back on again because since they're partially supported by the government, subsidized, they have to keep it up for 2 weeks. Well, guess who made a couple of copies of the video?
I wonder.
And distributed it all over the world in a big hurry.
Oh, you scamped.
Yes, there you go. But everybody... Everybody in the globe now has a copy of this piece of videotape, and Geller has been very silent. Well, the Israeli Society of Magicians, the president, their president, who I met some years ago, very nice lady, I thought, and but now she's come out on Geller's side, and she wants the contestants on the program, on the Israeli program, not to say that they're magicians or that they're not magicians, but they mention the Kabbalah all the time and Indian mysticism and such, which rather gives you a hint that maybe they're making moves in that direction being supernatural. And the magicians themselves are young kids. They don't know what to do. They're following her instructions. And the magicians are rebelling all over Israel about that.
Good.
And I think they're going to counter.
Yeah, good for them.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a good move if they would, because she's not representing magic. We don't, Todd, it's true, isn't it? We don't lie to people. We don't lie to them. We can deceive them, but
sure.
We don't tell them falsehoods that are going to change their way of thinking about the world.
And there is a very big difference.
Absolutely.
There is, at the end of the performance, you know it's a performance.
And my question always is, if I am going to be contacted by the spirit of my dead father-in-law through mm-hmm. John Edward, why would the spirit whisper to John Edward, my name starts with M or B? What kind of a game is this?
My theory is that they can't speak, so they're playing charades. And then Edward's saying, I see
sounds
a B.
Like,
sounds like
wait, it's a television
syllables.
Show.
See, I think you got it.
Yeah.
I think you got it, yeah. Well, I recovered through medical science with not one damn magnet, no acupuncture, no homeopathy, and my chakras stay unadjusted.
No therapeutic touching?
There you go. Well, maybe a little bit of that. That's a different story altogether. Different subject.
But leeches. Now, leeches, I got to tell you. Leeches,
that's
back.
True.
You mean lawyers?
Okay, redundant.
No, there are so many things we can wonder at and so many things we can celebrate. Mm-hmm. Look at any of the pictures that Phil Plait will show you from the Hubble telescope.
Oh, it's
damn.
It's glorious.
Doesn't it give you a chill? I just, whoa.
They should end every news service, every news broadcast with just one of those photos, just to let, instead of the, you know, good night and God bless and all this. This crap. Just look at that and just go, man, we've got a lot to do. Yeah. We've got a lot to do.
And just a simple statement like, the light from these stars has been traveling for 120 million years before it entered the Hubble Space Telescope and registered on a digital display. What you're seeing is 120 million years old. It's not yesterday.
Yeah, right. It's humbling, and that's the problem.
It is.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Because I take kids out sometimes at night when if I take my telescope out for any good reason. And looking at something or other, or a launch or whatever, and the kids stop by, I'll talk to them. I'll say, now look up at the moon. You're not seeing it as it is right now. What do you mean? Well, you're seeing it 1.5 seconds ago. And when you look at the sun during the day, you're seeing it 8.5 minutes ago. They say, yeah. And light that comes from those luminary bodies there, it goes at 186,000 miles every second. And you can see them go, whoa.
Yeah.
Because teachers haven't taught them this.
Yeah. Right. No.
They know it from me. Why should they know it from me? They should know it from teachers.
But Jesus doesn't want us to know this.
I keep forgetting.
Yes, please.
He keeps me straightened out.
You know, yes, I do what I can.
Yes, let's be fair, that there are some really great science teachers out there.
Oh, there are.
There are.
There are. And I had some.
Yeah.
Oh, did I have some.
And they're fighting an uphill battle.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes.
A lot of them are in that audience
right now.
We have given awards from the James Randi Educational Foundation to a couple of them who came out particularly loudly. And, you know, some of the schools where they teach, in Florida particularly, they get, as I did after one of my lectures at a high school in Florida a couple of years ago, I had a raft of parents come to me at the hotel. Almost, when I speak on campus now, people say, where are you speaking? And I say, well, it's at night, so just look for the glow of the torches.
Right,
and
the pitchforks.
The pitchforks, yes, and the scythes and such, and people going, you'll find it very easily. But during the day, they don't make that kind of noise, and they don't have the pitchforks usually.
Well,
but these people showed up at my hotel with their lawyer saying that they insisted that I and the high school principal talked together, and I gladly joined the parade, and I went over to the high school right across the street, and by golly, we went in to see the principal, and the principal just laid down the law to him and said, no, this is a legitimate lecturer, he knows his subject, he came here to educate the students, because at the end of my talk, the usual question, a young girl stood up and said, do you believe in God, Mr. Randi? I said, which God? Thor? No. Loki, maybe, and Minerva is my favorite.
She's a
and,
cutie.
No, I mean the God. Oh, you mean, what was his name? Jehovah. Yes. Oh, but there are several different varieties. No, the one God. You mean the creator of the world and the universe? Yes. I see. Well, there are many of those, too. Don't you realize there are hundreds of them out there? Which one do you believe in? Well, I'm a Catholic. And say, oh, I see, different from the Protestants. No, we believe in the same God. Oh, no. No, they're the God of Abraham, but there are several varieties to that, too. And, of course, then they're overwhelmed. They usually sit down at that point. Then a teacher stood up, and she looked at me, and she pointed, and she said, Mr. Randi, one of these days, you're going to be standing before the throne of God Almighty, and he will look down at you, and he will gesture to you and point you down to hell, and the devil will come and take you. And he'll take you on the end of a pitchfork. This is nice. You know, this is a Christian talking about it. Isn't it? Yeah. Nice people. Yeah. And on the end of a pitchfork, and he will march you down to hell where you will burn in torment forever after. And the audience cheered and hooed. You know, she believed it, literally. The pitchfork, the torment forever, and the whole. And I don't believe it. I hate to add that, but I know that destroys your faith in me. But, yeah, the religion thing is something that all of my life. Now, my story as a skeptic is, I spoke with my colleague Andrew Harder a few years ago. He was sitting in my office, and I just got this bug. I asked him, I said, Andrew, have you always been a skeptic? And he looked at me strange. He said, yeah, I guess so. He said, I remember when I was a little kid that I doubted all this sort of thing. He said, well, how about you? And I said, yes, I do remember as a little kid, the first thing that really got my attention, I was probably 5 or 6 or so, very small kid. The Santa Claus thing was, they tried to sell that to me.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, come on. Get out. Yeah, the equivalent of get out of here, you know, yeah. That you say at 5 or 6 years of age. And I looked at my parents very strangely from that moment on for the rest of their lives. Right. I looked at them very strangely. And when they eventually admitted to me that Santa Claus was a myth, I said, yeah, so? You know, and, oh, they were disappointed that I had already thought that way.
Right.
But I never had a moment when I believed all the crapiola. Mm-hmm. Really, never had a moment, or never had a moment when I doubted my skepticism. Matter of fact, I have a way of greeting skeptics. And I was in Copenhagen a couple of years back, and a fellow came running through the traffic and said, oh, you must be James Randi. He shook me by the hand, and I said, yes, I am. He said, I'm a skeptic, too. And I look him up and down and say, I doubt that. You know, you got to stay in character.
Of course. Consistency is what it's all about.
Right.
Oh, Wiseman's up there.
Richard Wiseman's
up there.
What a delight. What a delight he is.
He's a brilliant guy.
I have to step out of this anyway.
Yeah.
Go and tend to business. And
Richard will never let us hear the end of it.
Thank you for having me on The Skeptic Guide to the Universe.
Thank you so much for your time, Randy. Randy. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
Thank you
for joining
us.
Take care.
All right, take care.
Well, Hal Bidlack is with us. He took some time out of his extremely busy schedule as master of ceremonies for TAM 5 to chat with us for a few minutes. Hal, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
So how's it going out there?
Well, it seems to be going well. The speakers are great as always. The crowd is great. It's one of the great things about TAM is that we get great speakers, but the audience is equally qualified, equally spectacular. There are people out there who can talk about working with Oppenheimer, people who can talk about writing the first right to die law in the country that became such an important foundation of legal in the country. It's an amazing group of folks.
How long have you been a skeptic? I mean, that's really asking that question of everybody we talked to today.
Well, I'm 48, so 48 years and a day.
So this is just as long as you remember.
It was, you know, logic, evidence, and reason have always been a pretty good mantra to me. I'm kind of an odd duck in the JF in that I'm a deist. I'm not an atheist. Mm-hmm. It just has always seemed reasonable to me to look for evidence for things.
Right.
And I don't quite understand why that wouldn't be the normal view for most people, frankly.
Yeah.
It really, what's neat about it is it's the same kind of thing that I think a lot of people find in TAM, which is that they're not quite sure what it is they want to express. They're not quite sure what the voice is, and then they'll hear Randy, or they'll see Mythbusters, or they'll hear Julia, or Peter on his radio show, and they'll say, well, there's something about that that resonates.
Yeah.
And then so often they feel alone so much in about among the norms, you know, the regular folks who may not think as critically as others, and then they come here. And, you know, the term I use is it's nerdvana.
Yeah.
Because it's that's you belong. And, well, I'm stealing it from someone I choose not to give credit to. but it's one of those situations where you find yourself among friends that you've been your friends for 30 years, but you just met them yesterday.
Yeah, right, but you didn't realize it. Out of interest, what's your day job?
I actually just retired. I spent 25 years as an Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. I was a finger-on-the-button missile guy. I taught at the Air Force Academy. I worked at the White House, the State Department.
Wow.
And for most of that time, I taught political science at the Air Force Academy and was a cop. So the last couple of years, I did that, and then I retired on the 1st of September, and now I'm doing this odd thing. It's my part-time job where I perform around the country as Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that kind of full-time, writing a book about him and flying around and getting people to pay me to be, pretend to be a dead guy.
That's great. Overall, so you were in the military, you said 25 years?
25 years, 4 months, 10 days. They give you a very exact printout on your last day.
If you were to summarize the quality of the science in the military, maybe the quality of skeptical thinking or rational thinking with people that are in the military, how would you summarize that?
I think, like with any organization, it varies tremendously. My doctorate is in environmental politics, environmental security, and I worked on that quite a bit. And the Air Force, for example, is exceptionally advanced on that. There were, at one time when I was dealing with this, 1,400 full-time professionals dealing with environmental issues for the Air Force, which is more than Monsanto has.
Right.
And so, at least I think. I'm sorry if a Monsanto executive is listening, but I think that's right. Don't sue me.
We'll hear if they do. We'll
that's absolutely, that. Absolutely. Well, if I'm wrong, Phil Plait told me to say that. But
well,
you
he's
know,
everybody's butt boy. This
it's been mine for 5 years. Get in line. But, you know, it varies. I spent 25 years as a non-Christian Democrat in the Air Force, which at times was kind of a lonely view. But the thing that unites the folks in the military for the most part is, you know, a deep commitment to the Constitution, deep commitment to the country, which is not a partisan view. Mm-hmm. I'm actually in the process of trying to write some op-eds because I want to run for Congress. And one of them is about patriotism is not a political view. Definitely. Well, I'm an odd duck. The military background, I was in the Pentagon when the plane hit. I've done a lot of things.
You were
military,
inside the building when the plane
yeah.
hit?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. So, did you hear it? Could you hear the crash?
Well, it was a bad day. I actually didn't hear the crash. I ended up involved with some minor things trying to help out a little bit. But
it was a bad day. You were part of the cover-up then?
Yes. On the forum that's been mentioned, the stereo forum there, the folks, and I try to be charitable because I don't think you do a great deal of good when you demonize your adversaries.
Yes.
But on the issue of people who say that we faked the Pentagon, I can't be... I can't.
You hate
kind.
Those guys. Yeah. Really.
I don't hate them. I rage at them.
Rage. Yeah.
And I held part of that airplane in my hands.
Some notions.
It was covered with fuel. Any day that involves helping people with head wounds and burns, and you hold part of an airplane in your hand, and then someone says that you know you're either a liar or a dupe, it's kind of obscene.
Yeah.
And,
a
plane hit the airplane. Yeah. I mean, a plane hit the building.
Yeah.
A plane hit the building.
Yeah. It is obscene. We still get renewed anger whenever we. Get emails from people.
But the challenge, as you guys know far better than I do in your work, is to recognize that while there are some to be angry at, certainly people who are just entering this and are wondering, because as Phil said in his brilliant talk today about the moon hoax, if somebody says the shadows on the moon don't line up, it's reasonable for a thoughtful person to say, well, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And the correct response is not, well, you're stupid if you don't understand.
Yeah, of course.
And
yeah.
So even on issues like the Pentagon and 9/11, it's important that we be as open as we can.
Well, admit, I don't remember how many months ago it was. I brought to the – I saw the Loose Change video.
I've not been able to bring myself to watch it because I think I'd have to do something awful.
So, I'm a skeptic.
Sure.
I'm professionally, whatever, however you want to classify how good of a skeptic I am. But I brought it to the show, and I said, you know, what's up? And I was questioning things. I felt it was reasonable that I would question it, and the response I got from everyone on the show was pretty much kind of like, are you kidding? Come on, Jay. What are you know, why are you thinking that? Why would you even question those types of things? And I thought about it afterwards, and I thought it was perfectly reasonable for me to ask.
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Well, to bring it up as a topic, certainly.
I think what happened was what Loose Change does, what shows like that do, is they marshal a ton of factoids.
Absolutely.
That are cherry-picked.
Yeah.
They put them together in a very compelling sort of, wow, isn't this interesting, and we can't explain this, and what do you think about this fact? And too fast to process it with no real balance. And it's very easy to get overwhelmed, even if you generally know that this is BS.
Sure.
You still just, before you could figure out why there's something wrong with the first fact, they're on to the next interesting fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were just in that processing period where you're like, there's just some, I can't. Take all this in, and it made it seem like there was something there. But I think the difference is that the rest of us had already processed all of it. So it was just, I've got to get Jay up to speed, basically.
And I think skepticism is the framework that you bring to understanding issues. It's not the issue itself.
Right. It's a method.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
It certainly matters to a lot of people here. Oh,
shucks.
We better let you go before there's an empty stage and a lot of curious people wondering what's going on.
If people don't get their bad jokes every hour, they get really concerned.
That's right. Thanks.
Gents, my pleasure.
Thanks for taking the time out.
You bet.
We are here now with Jeannie Scott. Jeannie, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule today here at TAM 5. We just listened to your excellent lecture.
It's fantastic.
on of course, evolution, creationism, and the media. And you talked a lot about the challenge of getting our message across with a media who sometimes they get it, but not always. So can you tell us briefly what challenges you faced on a frequent basis with the media?
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of scientists who are really very nervous about dealing with the media. I mean, they really look at the media as somebody who's out to get them, or that they are just they don't think that they're capable of dealing with them.
They distrust them.
The media is your friend. I mean, don't be fearful of dealing with the media. But you need to understand what the media are all about. And this is true of print media. This is true of even more so. It's true in spades of visual media. And radio, of course, is the best medium, right? As we all know, because it allows you to get so much information across. Right. And the personality comes through as well, so it's even better. But seriously, the thing about American media is that they want to tell a story, and they also want to be balanced. And the telling a story part should not be offensive to scientists, because we learn through stories.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, if you're a teacher, you know that your students are going to learn more about whatever it is you're talking about it if you have some sort of a narrative.
Right.
This is one reason why a lot of scientists, when they teach, they give the history of the field. You know, well, how was this discovery made? Well, a long time ago, Professor so-and-so was... And, you know,
and
tell
in medicine,
a story.
We teach cases.
Yeah, and you teach
case,
cases.
You'll learn a disease That's much it. Better if you have a case to attach it to. It's a person's story.
Thank you for that reminder. I'll steal that from you. That's a good example.
You owe him a nickel every time you use it.
Well, you know, I believe in the Groucho Marx school of plagiarism, which is steal only from the best.
Right.
So I will steal that, Steve. So, you know, don't get all upset because they're making a story out of it. Just think about it a little bit, and, you know, that's easily. Yeah. The balance thing is something that drives scientists nuts. Because, and part of this is we need to educate the media about the difference between a science story and the difference between a policy or a political or a social whatever. A non-science story, okay?
An opinion story.
An opinion story, yeah. Because that to me is the key difference. Most of the work that a non-science reporter is going to be doing is dealing with opinion stories. Most of the time, they're going to be saying, you know, well, here down at the City Hall, we had this group saying this and this group saying that. And the job properly is to report accurately both of those points of view. And, you know, that's the mindset. It's not a bad mindset. Work with it. Now, I have no problem with somebody coming to a school board meeting and saying, creationist supporter Fred stood up and made these comments, you know, made these points about the new school board policy. And then science supporter Marjorie stood up and made these points about the new school board policy. That's no problem. Accuracy of reporting is a big part of balance. I mean, I would be really, really upset if one side was presented, the other side was presented accurately, and mine was presented inaccurately. We all would be. So we want them to get the story right. But to me, the bottom line, when you're dealing with the science issue, and of course the issue I deal with the most is the creation and evolution, is when you're dealing with an issue that is well established scientifically, such as evolution.
Right.
And biological evolution being human ancestry, or excuse me, ancestry of all living things. When you're dealing with an issue that's scientifically settled, like all creatures had common ancestors, you don't treat it as opinion. You report accurately. These people don't agree. These people say this and that and the other thing.
Right.
That's perfectly fine. But you really do violence to science if you give that alternate point of view scientific credibility.
Right.
And that's where I draw.
Yeah, in your talk you compared it to geocentrism, which I thought was
amusing. But that's why I also showed those data showing that, you know, I forget exactly what the number is, but there is a, what, about 25%
of Americans
of
people
who, you know, really kind of don't know.
Yeah, did not answer that question. Is the Earth or the Sun at the center of the solar system?
But, you know, that other little bit of data from the science and engineering indicators talking about the way of knowing, I mean, how science is about testing things and controlling variables.
Right.
If less than half of Americans, I think it was 43%, were able to say, this is a scientific study, this is not a scientific study, that bodes ill.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you made the point.
That's a science education issue.
Yeah, because one thing is facts, but the other is how we learn. And that's what is so lacking in our schools, I think.
How we know, not what we know.
How we learn what we know. And
Now, you made the point in your lecture that science journalists do a better job of reporting science than regular journalists.
That's been my experience.
But I've heard from several people anecdotally, I don't have any data on this, that a lot of major media outlets are basically getting rid of phasing out their science reporters, and they're just turning over science stories to their more general reporters. Have you found that to be true, and you think this is moving us in the wrong direction?
You know, I don't have data on that either. What I do know is that if you go to the National Science Writers Association, they're always grumbling and complaining about, you know,
about
we
that.
Don't get no respect.
Yeah.
But there seem to be a bunch of them. And I think it's the sort of thing you were talking about, I think, is more a function of the kind of media you're in and the size media.
Mm-hmm.
The big papers, you know, your big regional papers, your, you know, national papers, I mean, I would consider The Washington Post and the New York Times to be national papers.
Yeah.
LA Times to be a major regional paper. They will have people who are assigned science. But, you know, most of the writing that they do is medicine.
Mm-hmm. That's
true.
Medicine and technology. Yeah. A lot of science is actually medicine and technology, not really science.
Until we get a court case, like you showed on, you had a great graph.
Wasn't that interesting?
Showing big spikes whenever there's a court case. And Dover was huge in that respect, and I found it really interesting. A lot of your talk focused on how you guys use media to win at Dover. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about that? Because I thought that was fascinating.
In Dover took a year to prepare for.
Right.
The case came to trial in fall of 05, but we started in fall of 04. That's when the original complaint was written and filed, and then it just took several months for everything to work on through. Everybody knew this was going to be a big trial.
Yeah.
Because the issues in the trial did deal with science, because, not to get into a lot of First Amendment law at this point, but in Establishment Clause cases, it's okay to be a little religious in a way, but there has to be a secular reason for a policy. And, of course, the argument that the other side was making is that the secular reason is that it's good science.
Right.
That intelligent design is valid science, it's accurate science, it's cutting edge, and therefore... Yeah, well, okay, so there's these religious, but everything has religious implications. Mm-hmm. Well, after all, evolution has religious implications, so that was their argument. So obviously what we had to do, our job was to show that intelligent design was not science, that the only reason for teaching it was to promote a religious view.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew that both sides were going to be heavy on the science.
Yeah.
Now, nothing is going to turn a judge who, let's face it, not very many judges were scientists first.
Right.
Okay, most of these people are liberal arts background, and that's perfectly fine. Our judge was, I think, a history major. And so his whole attitude basically was, give me more. Give me everything you got. Lay everything on the table. He did not want to be a judge that anybody could come back and say, well, we weren't able to give our full position.
Right. And you guys...
This
you guys
is why it was a six-week trial.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you gave it to him. I mean, you guys really spelled it out clearly.
That's what we did. And the law firm, which had deep pockets, fortunately, decided to spend a lot of money on visual media.
Right.
And there was a PowerPoint situation with a data projector set up, and a guy who was worked for the firm that had all the equipment, and he was able to pull up, I mean, they scanned huge quantities of evidence, and he was able to pull up a letter, say, from the school board's lawyer to the school board. And then he would pull out a paragraph from the letter, which was just absolutely damning. And, the judge is seeing this on a screen. We in the courtroom are seeing it projected on the wall. And so those kinds of components of a trial, the fact of the case and so forth, those are extremely important.
Yeah.
But we were very concerned with this issue about, is intelligent design going to come across as a valid science? Because these guys are really good at framing.
They're slick.
Really good at rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And again, the American cultural tendency, which the press reflects, doesn't create, but the American cultural tendency is fairness and equal-handedness. Let's give everybody their chance to speak, and which by and large is very good. I want that in a culture. But like I say, applied to science, not quite the same thing. We do discriminate in science.
Right, we do.
We discriminate against the ideas that don't work.
Some theories are actually better than others in science.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all just opinion.
Not just opinion. So we wanted to present the science in a very careful, meticulous way so that a layman could understand, a smart, educated layman, which is what the judge is. This is all directed to the judge.
So have you, you've spent all the money to get these great audio visuals to put a compelling story together. Is there any plans to put that into a format that would be accessible to the public, like a DVD or something?
Funny you should mention. we're actually working on that now.
That's
and
great.
Part of it is just we, you know, we're losing our main IT guy. He's going off on leave of absence.
Yeah, they're hard to come back.
But there's a group, actually, of good guys that are trying to basically take the transcript. We have the transcript. Mm-hmm. If you want the transcript of the testimony, our website has it, and you can read along with Mitch. It's great.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do, since we have the slides from the various presenters, is to give you a little multimedia here, so to speak, so that you can look at the slides and read the transcript.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, we're working on that. But, of course, part of it is that some of the slides are proprietary, and we have to get permissions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, geez. So that's we really would like to do that.
Right.
Well, definitely let us know as soon as that comes out, because
we will want to make that as, and you know, we want it on the website, so anybody can just go up and snatch it.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, you're doing terrific work.
Thank you.
And you know, your lectures are always wonderful. And thanks for coming to TAM 5.
Yeah, thanks so much for making time for us.
I just wish I could stay longer.
Yeah, we do.
Great to see you guys again.
Yeah, good to see you too.
We'll meet again.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three new science news items or facts, two genuine, one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of most excellent skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is things you didn't know about TAM 5 speakers.
Oh, boy.
Uh-oh.
Okay, and there are four items this week. Everyone ready?
Ready.
Yep.
Item number one, Eugenie Scott wears a wig. Item number two, Phil Plait has 11 fingernails. Item number three, John Rennie once appeared in a commercial as a leprechaun.
Oh my God!
And item number four, Richard Wiseman once worked as a trapeze artist.
Oh God. Steve, you totally outdid yourself.
Now, three of those are real. Jay, why don't you go first?
Wow. Okay, absolutely, I have to hear these again.
All right, Eugenie Scott wears a wig. Mm-hmm. Phil, and I mean all the time. When you see her with her hair, that's a wig. Phil Plait has 11 fingernails. John Rennie once appeared in a commercial as a leprechaun. I cannot laugh if I want to say that.
Yeah, why? No. Why do you say that?
Why do you say that, boys?
John Rennie
is a great guy. He's really had so much fun with him this
Oh,
week.
God. John Rennie, he's awesome.
He was fun.
But he's a little vertically challenged, so that's why that's really funny.
We really did.
And Richard Wiseman once
he's
worked
not
as a trapeze
that short.
Artist.
I tried to steal his pot of gold.
Well, before I give the correct answer, I would like to say that I had so much fun with John. Interviewing him was incredible. We had a really good time. He was the kind of guy that I just wish I saw 10 times more over the weekend. I think he lives near us, doesn't he, Steve?
He lives in New York.
Yeah, we have to get together with him. Absolutely. And the answer is Phil has 11 fingernails.
Okay, Bob?
Wow. I could somehow imagine you finding out about 2, 3, and 4, the fingernails, leprechaun, and trapeze artist. But the wig one, I'm not sure how that would actually come up. And I think you probably wouldn't even say that if it was true. So I'm going to go with 1.
All righty. Evan?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking of the exact same thing. You know, how does it come up in conversation that this woman wears a wig? I mean, that's not just, you know, something I think a man discusses with a woman, right? So,
well,
I'm really
do you
want to
know how I got all this information?
You asked them.
I asked them to tell me something about themselves that is not generally known and would not be generally
known. Oh,
believed.
Hence your conversation with John. Okay.
Oh, boy. But this is tough.
This is hard.
I guess I really have to choose something here. Well, we had a good laugh with the John Rennie in the commercial. I think that was
good idea.
So for some reason, I don't know. Poor John.
John.
I will. It's either Scott or Rennie. All right, I'll say John Rennie in a commercial as a leprechaun is false.
Okay.
There you go.
Rebecca?
You know, I had to say that I totally developed a crush on John this weekend, and
so did I.
I think he's awesome enough to have appeared in a commercial as a leprechaun. I'm going to go with Jeannie Scott. I don't think she wears a wig.
Alrighty. So everyone agrees that Richard Wiseman once worked as a trapeze artist.
Absolutely.
And that is science, or that's true.
Science.
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 Scientific
Interestingly,
fact.
Everyone also agrees that Phil Plait has 11
Wait.
Fingernails.
That's bizarre.
No.
I picked that one.
Did Jay said that was
Oh, you said that
fiction.
Was not true. I'm sorry. So Jay doesn't. Jay thinks that one is not true. Jay,
apparently
I'm sorry.
It is true.
I'm sorry, Jay. That's true. Phil Plait has 11 fingernails. He showed them to me.
Explain that,
That's
Steve.
Creepy, Phil.
He's got two on one finger.
How?
He's a mutant.
He's got separated two fingernails on one finger. Yeah, some kind of bizarre developmental abnormality.
Separated vertically or horizontally?
Vertically.
That's only one of Phil's many interesting anomalies on
his body. The cosmic rays that are bombarding his body caused a mutation.
I think I need to see a picture of this before I believe it.
True skeptic.
Everyone but Evan thinks that John Rennie was in a commercial as a leprechaun.
We hope.
And that one is true.
Yes!
Of course that's true.
Oh, God, that's great.
Which means that Eugenia Scott does not wear a wig. I made that up.
But now you have to tell us, what's the strange thing that Jeannie Scott said?
Probably didn't even ask
stuff.
Her.
She didn't tell me anything, so that's why I had to make something up.
I
asked a couple other people, but they never got back to me. Michael Shermer agreed to get back to me, but then never did.
I heard you talking to him, and I saw you smiling, and you were like, oh, and Michael's like, yeah, all right, I'll get back to you. I'll think about it.
That's
he
what
knew
that
you
was
were going to accuse him of wearing a wig or being a leprechaun or having mutant fingernails.
He said, I was a born-again Christian. I'm like, everyone knows that, Michael.
Yeah.
You guys all know that he was a born-again Christian earlier
in
his life.
Well, okay, so now I need to ask our faithful listeners to scour YouTube for a clip of John dressed as a leprechaun. I will pay good money. I will give a delicious prize to anybody who can come up
John
with that.
John knows that you know we have a sizable audience, and he still gave up that information. He still said it.
That's impressive.
I like him twice as much as I did 10 minutes ago.
Oh,
Steve, how
man.
Long did you actually laugh when he told you that?
4-for-1.
you know, I think he's told us that before.
No.
Because
that would be burned into my mind.
When he
mind.
Said that to me, I'm like, that is strangely familiar. Or either that or maybe Steve Mirsky let that one slip.
No, I think it's because you had a dream of him dressed as a
You think that's what it is? No, it was great. I knew that was perfect. I mean, I had to use that one when he told me that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wiseman as a trapeze artist, that was a pretty easy one.
That's pretty cool.
I was hoping to get Rebecca. Rebecca knows Phil Plait really well.
I do, but
you didn't know that. I was hoping that
did
you were
going to... Did you specifically ask him for something that I wouldn't know?
Yes, of course. I told him what it was for. I said, Rebecca can't know it.
Yeah, and that's...
He was pretty sure you didn't know this. So I thought you would be so confident in your knowledge of Phil Plait that you would go for that one.
I was going to add that. I felt like that was the sort of thing that could be true about him, but I was a little saddened that there was something so prominent that I did not know about Phil. Now I do.
He's a Libra, too.
Well, I knew that.
No, I made that up.
He is a Libra.
No, he's not.
Okay.
Yeah, but Libras don't believe in astrology, so...
I'm psychic. Hey, Steve, you know, there's one more person we didn't thank for helping us, and that's our friend Jack.
Yes, a longtime friend and now Skeptics Guide fan, Jack Chodnicki. His actual name is Jacek, but he often goes by Jack. And he was at TAM5 with us, and he basically hang out with us and was our unofficial roadie, if you will.
I think there's a picture of him with us at the blackjack table, yeah. Right?
He's also the guy behind most of the photos that you'll see online. He actually took most of those pictures.
That's right.
Except for the one at the blackjack table, which I took and I got in trouble for. So
that's right.
Everyone had better be appreciative.
Evan, do you want to read last week's puzzle and tell us who won?
I've been chomping at the bit to read last week's puzzle and tell you who won. Oh, you mean now?
Yes, okay. right now would be nice.
The French and the Germans both agree, and so do Chinese, from 1200 BC. It only takes 10, placed upon 3. Peer through one eye, and you will soon see. Designed to impress children as young as 3, it dazzles adults, especially those that believe. All it takes is a skeptic to add fabric, you see. The magic disappears, and this trick is history. What is it?
I had no idea.
The answer is a Ouija board.
Yes.
Of course. It was guessed actually pretty quickly by Mike on the message boards. He's gotten a couple puzzles correct.
What was the claw thing?
The way you test people to see if they have real power is using a Ouija board. You blindfold them. And that's it. They can't do it. Suddenly, the magic disappears. Funny that.
That was good, Evan. Excellent. I listened to that about 5 or 6 times, and nothing tickled my brain on it at all. Very good.
Well, I think people are going to have a challenge with this week's puzzle, though.
Let's hear it.
I made this one especially tricky, and I'll be very impressed to the first person who gets this. So here is this week's puzzle. If an insane person loses power and decides that the only way to restore the power is to make a list, send it to God, then informs other people of this and apologizes to them for the power failure, what has this person actually experienced? So chew on that for a while, and good luck.
Okay.
Alrighty. Thank you, Puzzle Master Evan. Well, that's our show for this week, the TAM 5 wrap-up show. All we have left is Bob's skeptical quote
of
the week.
Yes, I have one from Jerry Spence. He's a lawyer and author of How to Argue and Win Every Time. He said, I would rather have a mind opened by wonder than one closed by belief.
Very nice. Very pithy, as we say. Well, guys, thanks again for joining me.
Good episode. Really good episode.
Still recovering from Vegas, though, huh?
A little bit.
Yeah, we're still recovering. Still a little jet-lagged for the time delay. We have to record more often all in the same place.
That was so much
fun. Yeah, we should do that. We should plan on that.
And we can't wait 18 months to the next TAM
18?
6. Yeah, they're going to do it in June of 2008 as the scuttlebutt.
Is that official yet?
I think it's official, but there's going to be a mini-TAM in January.
A mini-TAM?
A mini-TAM in Fort Lauderdale.
And then a full one in Las Vegas? Hmm.
Just like a one-day thing or something. Just to hold you over.
Just to hold us over. Well, we'll link to any TAM info when it becomes official.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that'll be on the JREF webpage, so most of you probably peruse that website from time to time. Thanks again, everyone, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.